We'll get started again. Welcome back from the break. I'm Sonia Skrolatis from the National Heart, Lung, and Blood Institute, and I'm going to be chairing the session on cardiac disorders. Our first speaker of the cardiac disorder session on stem cell therapies is Dr. Douglas Losordo. Dr. Losordo received both a BS and MD from the University of Vermont. He completed fellowships in molecular biology, interventional cardiology, and cardiology at St. Elizabeth's Hospital in Boston. He joined the faculty at the Tufts University School of Medicine in 1983 and was appointed professor of medicine in 2004. In 2001, he became the chief of cardiovascular research at St. Elizabeth's, and in 2003 was appointed the acting chief of cardiology. Dr. Losordo recently joined the Feinberg School of Medicine, Northwestern University, as the director of the Feinberg Cardiovascular Research Institute. His research interests focus on angiogenesis, vascularogenesis, progenitor and adult stem cells, tissue repair and regeneration, vascular biology, and the effects of estradiol on vascular tissue. He is the author of or co-author of more than 100 articles, and today he will be speaking about clinical trials on cell-based therapies for cardiac repair.
There we go. Okay, thank you, Sonia, and thank you for the opportunity to speak to you all. So my charge today is really to summarize the existing data from clinical trials of cell-based therapies for cardiac repair. So this is going to be a very clinically oriented discussion and kind of a literature review. So because there have been several or many sort of smaller exploratory studies, I wanted to limit because of the time of my discussion. So this will be a review of published randomized controlled trials involving cell administration in at least 20 or more subjects with myocardial ischemia or myocardial dysfunction. So one of the first studies that came out generated a lot of attention initially and then subsequently was a so-called BOOST study. This was a study by a group of German investigators in patients with a myocardial infarction in which bone marrow mononuclear cells were infused shortly after the occurrence of this of the infarction. And the initial observations that were made and published in Lancet in 2004 from this group showed that in the control group, those patients randomized to receive just standard therapy, a mean change of ejection fraction over 6 months occurred that was 0.7%, so a very modest change. And the notable finding at that time was a 6.7% increase in the global left ventricular ejection fraction, so the squeezing ability of the heart muscle, if you will, was noted to be increased. To their credit, these investigators continued to follow these patients over time. And so the panel that I'm showing you here is from a paper that was published in Circulation a couple of years ago showing the 18-month follow-up. And what the investigators showed then was that the control group exhibited a continued, if you will, improvement over 18 months so that the net change in ejection fraction was 3.1%. The active treatment group showed a slight decrease in the overall global change, and so that at 18 months, actually, the statistical difference between the two treatment groups had disappeared. So now there was no statistical difference, even though there was still that numerical difference. And so this, of course, generated a lot more discussion about the potential loss of effect or what was responsible for the initial effect and so on and so forth. Also in 2004, a group of investigators led by Chen published their findings in which they used an autologous bone marrow-derived mesenchymal stem cell preparation. These were mesenchymal cells that were cultured from the patient's own bone marrow for about 10 days and then administered in patients who had had a recent myocardial infarction. And I'll just call your attention to a few of the observations that were made by these groups that were statistically different. Most notably, the patients that were treated with the active stem cell preparation noted an improvement in the global left ventricular ejection fraction from 49% up to 67%. The control group also showed an improvement from 48 to 53 and then 54% at 6 months, which is pretty consistent with what is observed normally. But the overall difference in these changes was statistically significant. So these investigators concluded at that time that there was some association between improvement and the infusion of these of this mesenchymal stem cell preparation. Probably the study that is the studies that have received the most attention, another European study, this from a group in Frankfurt, Germany, actually two studies, one in acute patients with an acute myocardial infarction, and then subsequently I'll show you data from a chronic infarct group with heart failure. So this study was published in New England Journal in 2006, and this shows you the study design of the so-called REPAIR AMI study. So it was a double-blind, placebo-controlled, randomized, multicenter study in patients who had come in with an acute ST segment elevation myocardial infarction and had had successful reperfusion therapy, so either an angioplasty or successful stent procedure had been performed. 3 to 5 days later, patients who consented were randomized. They all received a bone marrow aspiration, and then patients either received an infusion of the medium that was used to contain the bone marrow mononuclear prep. This was a Fi-Qol gradient preparation of the mononuclear cells from the bone marrow aspirate, or the bone marrow, the autologous bone marrow progenitor cells themselves. So that was an intracoronary infusion. 3 to 6 days after the index event, left ventricular angiograms were performed at baseline, and then 4 months later at follow-up. And what was seen at 4 months follow-up was that in both the placebo and the active treatment arms, there was an improvement in global left ventricular ejection fraction. However, the primary endpoint of this study was the absolute change in left ventricular ejection fraction, which was both numerically and statistically greater in the patients who received that intracoronary infusion of their own bone marrow mononuclear cells. So the study hit its primary endpoint. We can certainly talk about the relevance of that that finding. One of the interesting follow-ups of this was an assessment of microvascular function in these patients. So these graphs depict the coronary flow reserve CFR and the infarct vessel at baseline and 4 months. And you can see that in both the active treatment group and the placebo group, there was some improvement in microvascular function as measured by coronary flow reserve. That absolute change was greater in the subjects who received the infusion of their own bone marrow progenitor cells. The same group in that same issue of the journal also published results of the same approach, that is the autologous bone marrow mononuclear cells, but this in a patient population that had had a chronic event. So there was a pilot study in these subjects and then a larger randomized trial in which circulating progenitor cells, a control infusion, or bone marrow-derived progenitor cells were infused into the coronary, and then there was a crossover phase of this study as well. Just wanted to point out in this graph, in terms of the medical history, the mean time since the most recent MI in these patients was quite long, so in the neighborhood of 80 months since the index event or most recent myocardial infarction in these patients with chronically reduced left ventricular ejection fraction. Without going into detail in this relatively busy chart, what was found was that the subjects who received an infusion of their own bone marrow mononuclear cells showed an increase, although modest, that was statistically significant compared to their baseline. This follow-up was obtained at 3 months after the infusion of these mononuclear cells. Also reflected in a change in regional contractility that was superior in the subjects who received the bone marrow mononuclear cells compared to the other treatment groups. As I mentioned, there was a crossover, which was quite interesting. So patients were crossed over from placebo to bone marrow mononuclear cells or from circulating progenitor cells to bone marrow mononuclear cells, from control to circulating progenitor cells, or from control to bone marrow mononuclear cells. And you can see in all these cases there was some evidence even after the acute administration of cells and administration of bone marrow mononuclear cells, or in this case circulating progenitor cells, seemed to be associated with an objective increase in overall left ventricular ejection fraction. Now, that was starkly contrasted in the same issue of the New England Journal with the results of the ESTAMI study, which on the surface looked very similar to the two previous studies that I showed you, that is, involved the infusion of a bone marrow preparation. The preparation of the cells, in fact, in the study was slightly different than the preparation used in the two previous studies. I'm showing you follow-up data here from the Journal of the American College of Cardiology, just published the last few months, but the initial observations from this group were published in that 2006 New England Journal of Medicine, and the follow-up in this group showed the same thing that the original publication did, which was that there was, in this case, no observed significant change in the active treatment versus the control, either by ejection fraction, wall motion score index, or left ventricular end diastolic volume. Stefan Janssens from Belgium also published work, this in The Lancet, in 2006. Again, a very similar study to the work by the Frankfurt group. And Stefan's observations in this acute myocardial infarction patient population using a bone marrow mononuclear cell preparation was that there was really no difference between the improvement in the control population, about a 2% improvement, and the improvement observed in the bone marrow stem cell infused group. So two negative studies contrasting with two positive studies which used what appeared to be relatively similar, although there were clearly differences between the approaches, the timing of the infusion, the preparation of the cells that distinguished these studies. More recently, a Japanese group undertook an intracoronary infusion of non-expanded peripheral blood-derived mononuclear cells. So these were in non-mobilized patients who had had a recent myocardial infarction, underwent apheresis to collect the non-selected mononuclear cells from these patients that were subsequently infused into the infarct-related coronary artery. And here are the findings from these patients. So the control group showed an improvement in overall ejection fraction from 48 to 56. The control group showed a numerically greater, you can see here, a mean change of ejection fraction 7.4% in the controls, a mean change in ejection fraction of 13.4% in the subjects who received an infusion of their own peripheral blood-derived mononuclear cells. A couple of things that are notable about this study, even on the surface, is that the ending ejection fraction is the same, 56 and 57%, in the control and treatment group. The difference here is really based upon the lower ejection fraction that occurred in that the treatment group, the active treatment group, had at baseline compared to the control group. But nevertheless, those observations were made and published relatively recently. And so there you see the absolute change in ejection fraction, control, and peripheral blood mononuclear cell, which turned out to be statistically significant, that absolute change in ejection fraction. Other indices of function in this study, such as end-diastolic volume index and end-systolic volume index. Oops, sorry about that. I guess there's no way to go backwards here. Let me see if I can. There we go. Although they were statistically changed within each treatment group, the differences between the treatment groups were not statistically different, at least as far as these volume indices go. Our own group has been interested in the CD34 cell population, a selected subpopulation of the mononuclear cells. So Sylvia Tescu and Alfred Coker published this paper in Nature Medicine back in 2001 in a nude rat infarction model, and showed that the intravenous infusion of human CD34 cells was associated with a significant recovery in left ventricular ejection fraction compared to negatively selected cells, saphenous vein endothelial cells, or saline control. And based on preclinical work in our lab and others, we undertook a study, a pilot study, of patients with intractable angina, class 3 or class 4 angina, attempted best medical therapy. These were non-candidates for any surgical or percutaneous revascularization, failed best medical therapy, randomized to receive an intramyocardial injection of one of three doses of CD34 cells versus placebo. So these patients were mobilized with G-CSF at 5 mics per kilo per day, underwent leukoapheresis on day 5, and then selection of CD34 cells and then injection by an intramyocardial technique on day 6, discharge the following day, and followed for up to a year. And I won't show you all the data here, but angina frequency was certainly the primary endpoint since this was an intractable angina study. There was a placebo effect, interestingly. So by 6 months, the mean frequency of angina in the placebo group had decreased, although that was not statistically significant. The active treatment arm in a small pilot study did show a decrease relative to the placebo group. And quality of life indices, the Seattle Angina Questionnaire, showed a net benefit to the active treatment arm compared to the controls. So we did embark on, and now we've actually completed, a phase 2B study at 20 U.S. sites that was just finished in March. I can't show you that data yet since we're still in the follow-up phase, but hopefully by around this time next year we'll have reported the results of this relatively large, certainly for the United States, randomized placebo-controlled study in these intractable angina populations. We've also generated data that the same approach can recover hibernating myocardium. This is in a porcine model of ischemic cardiomyopathy. So the in direct injection of progenitor cells into the ischemic myocardium recovers LV function compared to control groups. And so we actually have an IND approved for a double-blind phase 1-2A study, but funding is pending, and hopefully we'll get lucky at study section next month for this pilot study. Most recently, Philippe Menaché and his colleagues from Europe have published this paper of the use of autologous myoblasts. So these are cultured human autologous myoblasts injected into the ischemic myocardium in patients with ischemic cardiomyopathy, a randomized placebo-controlled study. It was a negative study as far as improvements in LV function or quality of life indices overall clinical benefit. One thing that was notable, this is the ventricular arrhythmia free survival, and it's a little bit hard to see on this chart, but this lower line here is actually the high-dose cell group. And so there was an observation of an increase in ventricular arrhythmias in the subjects who received an intramyocardial injection of their own cultured myoblasts. So that was a safety observation that's, of course, quite important and will need to be followed. So then to summarize this really whirlwind tour of the literature on clinical trials, autologous cell administration via intracoronary or intramyocardial route has not resulted in adverse safety signals. The intramyocardial skeletal myoblast injection was associated with an increased observation of ventricular arrhythmias. Autologous bone marrow-derived cells have shown some evidence of improving LV function, although there are certain questions revolving around cell type, timing of infusion, and really the overall impact of these therapies in different patient populations. Important elements to consider as we think about this. Certainly no phase 3 studies have been completed, so there's really no definitive efficacy answer yet. Placebo effects in these patients are quite real and have to be contended with when we think about trial design. In the advanced cardiovascular disease population, disease progression will continue, which really complicates our selection of endpoints and which endpoints we measure in these patients. It's fair to say, as many have noted today, the mechanism of action, if there is in fact a beneficial mechanism of action, is incompletely characterized. And I think also the correct method to quantify in vivo biologic activity in human subjects is unknown. And so with that, I will thank you for your attention and be happy to answer your questions.
Any questions? Doug, do you want to elaborate a little bit about timing after post-MI for delivery of cells, and what do you think about the different cell deliveries?
Sure. Well, so, you know, certainly we all learned in medical school from classical studies that were done by the Jennings group at Duke University the importance of intervening in the setting of an acute ischemic injury as soon as possible. And so everybody's instinct, I think, in this field was that the sooner that one intervened in the setting of an acute ischemic injury, the greater the likelihood of benefit. And paradoxically, the observation that's been made has been exactly the opposite. And that is that at least there's been an association between a later infusion of cells and a greater magnitude of benefit. Now, these are really early observations, and so it's not definitive yet, but certainly it sent a lot of people back to the lab scratching their heads, wondering why a later intervention should be more efficacious. But one thing I think that we can say that's been pretty consistently observed, and especially in the larger studies, is that delay of several days really does not seem to obviate the possibility of benefit for the infusion of these cells. And that's very interesting to everybody in the field of study of ischemic injury, because it suggests that the therapeutic window is a lot bigger than we previously thought. There's been a lot of justified enthusiasm for early intervention in acute ischemic injuries, stroke, myocardial infarction, and so forth, and a direct correlation between reopening vascular supply of the macrovessels and clinical benefit. It seems, though, that especially for some of these microvascular-directed therapies, that there is a much longer time window in which we can do something useful, and so we may actually be able to do things that are helpful to patients. And I guess that's most obvious in the Zaire study in patients who hadn't had an acute insult for 80 months or so and who appeared at least numerically to have improvement in ejection fraction. Route of administration is another question that has come up. I think it will be different for different settings. Certainly, if there's a patent vascular supply into the target territory, that's a convenient way to deliver a therapeutic into that zone. In other settings, when there is no antegrade blood supply into that territory, then the intramyocardial or direct surgical application of a therapy seems to have some benefits. Yes?
The benefit that you described is real. So how much does it cost per patient to get this, what looks to be fairly marginal improvement? How much additional cost per person would that introduce?
Yeah, so I mean, that's a really good and important question, and I guess, you know, the scale of it, it's always hard to answer those cost questions, you know, while you're still in phase two, because I think they haven't been worked out. The approach that the German group has taken of using bone marrow mononuclear cells, I don't think is terribly costly, but, you know, certainly if you scale that up, you talk about a trip to the cath lab, you know, you're probably talking in the neighborhood of $20,000 or so, you know, in that ballpark. And these are, you know, these are best faith estimates. So, you know, how does that compare to the cost of an angioplasty, which is done to relieve symptoms or, you know, or improve LV function? It's probably in that same neighborhood of overall cost. You know, we could debate about whether those procedures are justified, but at least it certainly, I think, is in the same neighborhood of current costs that are applied to these types of patients. You know, the modest benefit that was seen overall, let's just talk about the Repair MI study. So that was about a 2.9% global ejection fraction improvement as a mean. One of the questions, of course, is, you know, who are the patients that got better? And can we identify, you know, if it works, as you say, are there subpopulations of patients in whom we know that the benefit will be there versus those who are relatively immune to the benefit, and therefore we can avoid exposing those patients to a therapy that probably doesn't have a huge chance of helping them, and also avoid the cost of treating patients in whom the cost is, in whom the benefit is probably going to be modest. So I think it's, you know, those sorts of questions will help us to decide whether the cost-benefit ratio is there.
A related question. So it sounds like, seems like putting a catheter in there and so forth is not totally innocuous. So what are the side effects of this procedure? And in the liver autologous cell transplantation field, there have been anecdotal reports of autoimmune complications after injection of large doses of mononuclear cells. So do you know whether anyone's developed an autoimmune complication or other complications after these procedures?
Yeah, so the catheter side of this is certainly there's risks associated with any time you stick a catheter in a coronary artery or especially if you put a needle into the myocardium, there will be risks associated with that. And of course, those need to be tabulated. So far, the risks of the procedures themselves have not resulted in the halting of these studies. Autoimmune phenomena, I'm not aware of any reports so far.
I can tell you a little bit more about the costs.
We have a cardiovascular cell therapy network that the Institute is supporting. And for post-MI, autologous bone marrow cells, intracoronary delivery, depends on the center, but the price can range between $12,000 to $17,000 per patient.
Yeah, good guess. Thank you, Doug. So our second speaker is Dr. Anna Rosa Leary. Dr. Leary received her MD at the University of Parma in Italy. She is an associate professor in the Department of Anesthesia and Medicine at Brigham and Women's Hospital at Harvard Medical School. Dr. Leary has focused her work on the role of cardiac stem cells in myocardial homeostasis and growth. She has documented that the adult heart possesses structures with the architectural organization of stem cells niches, which regulate myocyte and coronary vessel turnover. Over the years, she has promoted the critical function that the telomere-telomerase axis has in myocardial aging and heart failure. And her presentation today has changed. There's a revised abstract in your book. Her title is Cardiac Progenitor Cells and Aging Myopathy. Dr. Leary?
Thank you, Sonia. So recently we have addressed the issue of myocardial aging, and the fundamental question concerns whether the aging process of the heart is truly reversible, or and very little or nothing can be done to repair the old heart, or whether strategies can be developed to postpone, delay, or reverse the evolution of the aging myopathy. So today I would like to discuss about the role of cardiac progenitor cell in the aging myopathy, and in an attempt to understand whether the aging myopathy is dictated by the depletion of the resident cardiac progenitor cell pool and accumulation of old myocytes, whether myocardial aging affects uniformly all cardiac progenitor cell, or whether a subset of functionally competent cardiac progenitor cell persist in the senescent heart, and if this second hypothesis were to be true, whether the effects of aging on cardiac remodeling can be reversed by activation, mobilization, and differentiation of cardiac progenitor cell that may ultimately repair the decompensated senescent heart. There is no perfect model of organism aging, and there is no perfect model of cardiac aging. We are currently studying three models of genetically engineered mice, but the data that I'm going to show today are collected in normally aging Fischer 344 rat. The senescent rat heart have similarities both from an anatomical and a functional point of view with the human old heart. And so we have decided to study this model. To answer the first two questions, we assess the number and distribution of cardiac progenitor cell in the heart, the number of myocytes, and the growth behavior of cardiac progenitor cell and the myocyte formation. Career progenitor cell express the stem cell antigen c-kit and are organized in niches which are located in ill-defined regions of the interstitial. Cardiac niches accumulate preferentially in the atria and apex. This schematic representation on the right helps to understand in a very simplified manner the hierarchical organization of cardiac stem cell and their progeny within a niche. In this niche contains 14 c-kit positive cells. Only the two at the center of the niche are negative for a lineage marker and therefore correspond to the true stem cell within the niche. The other 12 c-kit positive cells express the cardiac transcription factor GATA4. And we have defined these cells as myocyte progenitor, are shown here in yellow. These cells are in an early phase of commitment towards the myocyte lineage. And there are two cells which are shown at higher magnification in this inset, which express, in addition to the stem cell antigen and the transcription factor GATA4, a thin layer of cytoplasm which is positive for sarcomeric protein, in this case for myosin heavy chain. These two cells correspond to myocyte precursor, as shown here in orange, and are further down in the differentiation program of cardiac progenitor cell. At the periphery of the niche, there are also two small developing myocytes, which correspond to transient amplifying myocytes. This niche was found in the apex of a senescent Fischer 344 rat at 29 months of age. First, we measured the number of cardiac progenitor cells in Fischer 344 rats at 4, 12, 20, and 28 months of age. Surprisingly, the number of cardiac progenitor cells increased with age in all three anatomical regions that we consider, atria, base, mid portion, and apex. To assess whether this increased number corresponds to an increased number of functionally competent progenitor cells, we utilize the marker of cellular senescence P16. P16 is an inhibitor of the cell cycle, and it has been recently shown that the expression of P16 is coupled with the stem cell senescence in several organs, in the brain, in pancreas, and in the bone marrow. This is a niche in a Fischer 344 rat at 20 months of age, and as you can see, the majority of cardiac progenitor cells express P16. Quantitatively, the number of P16 positive cell increases with age from 4% to approximately 80% in senescent rats. Similarly, the number of apoptotic cardiac progenitor cell increases progressively with age. Therefore, by subtracting from the total number of cardiac progenitor cell the number of cells which are senescent or which are apoptotic, we could calculate the number of functionally competent cardiac progenitor cell that are the cells that can still proliferate and differentiate. The pool of functionally competent cardiac progenitor cell remains pretty stable up to 20 months of age, but then decreases sharply at 28 months of age. Therefore, the expansion of the cardiac progenitor cell compartment with age is characterized by the accumulation of old non-replicating and dying P16 positive cells. We wanted to see whether the same phenomena apply to the myocyte compartment, and we saw that with age, the number of apoptotic myocytes as well as necrotic myocytes increases progressively. And in the same manner, the number of senescent myocytes increases from the newborn heart to a 27-month-old heart. The accumulation of senescent myocytes indicate that there is a defect in cardiac progenitor cell if we believe that myocytes derive from the activation and differentiation of cardiac progenitor cell. Cardiac progenitor cell undergo progressive differentiation into myocyte progenitor, precursor, transient amplifying myocyte, and then give rise to fully differentiated myocyte. So to see whether there is a growth defect in the senescent heart, we measure the number of myocyte progenitor and precursor on the basis of the expression of the transcription factor MEF2C and the sarcomeric protein myosin heavy chain. The number of myocyte progenitor increases with age, and the same is true for the number of myocyte precursor. Then we measured proliferation of myocytes by chronically labeling animals with BRDU. We administered BRDU for 1 month. We gave 56 injections twice a day to young rat and to old rat. In the left panel is nuclei are labeled by propidium iodide. In the central panel, green fluorescent correspond to BRDU labeling. And in the right panel, the staining with alpha sarcomeric actin allows to recognize the myocyte nuclei, the myocyte and the nuclei that pertain to myocyte. BRDU positive myocyte nuclei are indicated by the arrowheads. Of course, there are many interstitial cells which are also labeled by BRDU. Quantitatively, the number of BRDU-labeled myocytes increases with age from 5% to 15% at 28 months of age. The higher proliferation of myocytes was confirmed by the mitotic index measured both in tissue section and in isolated myocytes. These are two examples of mitotic figures in myocytes in which chromosomes are labeled by phosphohistone H3. Therefore, the senescent heart seems to contain a pool of functionally competent cardioprogenitor cells, which upon activation retain the ability to form new myocytes. However, it is strange that if there is this pool of functionally competent cardioprogenitor cells, we still have accumulation of senescent myocytes and a decrease in myocyte number with age. So we decided to study telomere length. Telomere length is a powerful tool to assess the proliferative potential of cells. This is a typical preparation of c-Kit-positive cells that we obtain after enzymatic digestion of the heart and sorting for c-Kit by FACS. This is a population that is homogeneous in terms of expression of c-Kit, but is heterogeneous with respect to the degree of differentiation of the cells. The majority of the cells are non-differentiated, express only the stem cell antigen c-Kit, but then there is a group of cells which are differentiating and express a transcription factor of the myocyte lineage, such as NKX2.5, and a few of them express also cytoplasmic protein, which are typical of myocyte, in this case alpha-sarcomeric actin. In these c-Kit-positive cells, we measure telomeres by Q-FISH, which are shown here by magenta fluorescent dot. And we perform the same measurement of telomere length in transient amplifying myocyte in a tissue section. And these are the results. This is a very crowded slide, but I would like to focus on a few things. In the first line, in each panel, is indicated the average telomere length. As you can see, in all the three cell populations that we studied, cardioprogenitor cell, myocyte progenitor precursor, and amplifying myocyte, the average telomere length decreased markedly from 3 months to 27 months of age. Similarly, the distribution of telomere length was shifted to the left in 27-month-old animals towards shorter telomeres. The red bars correspond to P16 positive cells, while the green bars correspond to Ki67 positive cells. Since amplifying myocytes by definition are proliferating cells, these cells are all Ki67 positive. In spite of the fact that there is a reduction in average telomere length, in old animals we still have approximately 20% of cardioprogenitor cell with a telomere length which is greater than 18 kilobase pair, which is very similar to the average telomere length found in the young rat, which means that this 20% of cardioprogenitor cell still have a high growth reserve or proliferative ability. This is also true for myocyte progenitor and precursor, although the number of amplifying, the fraction of amplifying myocyte which has this long telomere length is markedly decreases, only 4%, indicating that telomere attrition in cardioprogenitor cell with age leads to degeneration of a myocyte progeny that rapidly acquires the senescent phenotype, conditioning organ aging. So to answer the third question, which is whether we can do something for the aging heart, we decided to study growth factor receptor system. C-Kit-positive cardioprogenitor cell express the receptor for IGF-1, IGF-1R, c-MET, which is the receptor for hepatocyte growth factor, and the type 1 of the angiotensin II receptor. Additionally, C-Kit-positive cells express in their cytoplasm the three ligands, IGF-1, HGF, and angiotensin II. The presence of the ligand in the cytoplasm of the cardioprogenitor cell does not discriminate whether the cardioprogenitor cell are actually able to synthesize this ligand or if these ligands are picked up from the circulation. Therefore, we decided to study the components of the this trigger fat receptor system first by real-time RT-PCR. With aging, there is a decrease in the quantity of the transcript for IGF-1 receptor. The fold changes here are with respect to animals at 3 months of age. And there is also a decrease of the transcript for the ligand IGF-1 at 24 months of age, indicating that the IGF-1 IGF-1 receptor system is attenuated with age in the heart. CMET decreased only modestly at 12, 16, and 24 months, and there was a small decrease in the quantity of HGF messenger RNA at 24 months of age. Renin increased at 12 and 16 months and decreased slightly at 24 months. Both angiotensinogen and 81 receptor decreased markedly with age. However, in spite of these changes in messenger RNA, the quantity of the protein for angiotensinogen and 81 receptor remained constant at 27 months of age, indicating that the renin-angiotensin system is intact with age. Then we wanted to see whether the cardiac progenitor cell are able to produce the ligand and whether the production of ligands changes with age. Young cardiac progenitor cell isolated from 3-month-old rats, IGF-1 is produced in higher quantity with respect to 27 months of age, and the same is true for HGF. The opposite is true for angiotensin II, which is produced in higher quantity in old cardiac progenitor cells. So, collectively, these results indicate that aging negatively affect growth factor system involved in cardiac progenitor cell proliferation, survival, and migration, potentiating the consequences of the local renin-angiotensin system on cardiac progenitor cells. We wanted to see whether these ligands have an influence on the proliferation of cardiac progenitor cell, and IGF-1, HGF, and the combination of these two growth factors increases the proliferation mostly in young cells. The proliferative ability of old cardiac progenitor cell is attenuated but is not completely abolished. Angiotensin II had no growth promoting effect but promoted apoptosis mostly in old cardiac progenitor cells. We then expanded in vitro cardiac progenitor cell to see whether there was a pool of cardiac progenitor cell in the old rat heart which was able to proliferate for a long period of time. And these are after 20 passages and the population doubling time and the fraction of BRDU positive cells is similar at 27 months of age. Of course, by serially passaging the cells in vitro, we have selected in the old heart the cardiac progenitor cells which are capable of proliferating. Telomerase activity was decreased by 33%, but still old cardiac progenitor cell possessed a significant level of telomerase activity, indicating that myocardial aging does not deplete completely the pool of functionally competent cardiac progenitor cell. Based on this result, we decided to perform an experiment, and the hypothesis was to try to mobilize cardiac progenitor cells from their site of storage in the niches of the atria and apex, and mobilize this cell towards the mid region of the ventricle where the majority of the damage is located. We injected at the atrioventricular groove and in proximity of the apex a retrovirus carrying EGFP to label cycling cells. And 2 days later, we injected growth factor in these sites, indicated by numbers, at increasing concentration from the atria and from the apex towards the ventricle. The objective was to create a chemotactic gradient and attempt to mobilize the cardiac progenitor cell from the site of storage towards the left ventricle. The animals were sacrificed 45 days later, and throughout the period of observation, they received BRDU in the drinking water. We performed this experiment in 3 groups of rats at 15, 20, and 27 months of age. This is an example of a niche after labeling with the EGFP carrying retrovirus. This is not a representative example because actually the efficiency of infection in vivo was pretty low, about 10%. And this is one example of myocytes which are labeled by EGFP, which were present in the left ventricular wall of a senescent rat at 29 months of age. This is, of course, EGFP labeling. The arrows in this central panel indicate the position in which the EGFP label structure are located, and this is the colocalization of EGFP and myosin heavy chain, indicating that the EGFP positive cell correspond to a newly formed myocyte. The scatter distribution of this newly formed myocyte correspond to the scatter distribution of damage, which is typical of the senescent rat art. This is another example in which there is a huge cluster of small newly formed myocytes, which are EGFP positive and BRDU positive. Again, this is typical of the senescent rat art, which shows a large foci of myocardial damage. We quantify the extent of regeneration by measuring the number of EGFP positive structure, which, however, did not correspond to the actual amount of regeneration because of the low efficiency of infection. We measured also BRDU label myocyte, and as you can see, there is an increase in the number, in the fraction of BRDU label myocyte with age, indicating that the old heart by itself still retains some ability to regenerate myocyte. However, this ability is increased after treatment with the growth factor. This increase in the number of BRDU label positive myocyte was paralleled by a 20% decrease in the fraction of senescent myocyte. And these are the anatomical parameters after treatment. After treatment, we saw an attenuation in chamber dilation and an increase in mass to chamber volume, as well as hemodynamical improvement, which were particularly apparent in the treated rats at 28-29 months of age. This improvement in the function of the rats is particularly apparent when we perform the echocardiography. In the untreated rat, we see an increase in dilation, which was instead decreased in the treated rats, a decrease in ejection fraction with time, and an increase in ejection fraction after treatment. Finally, I want to show you a few slides in which we have made a comparison between untreated rats at 16 to 17 months of age and treated rats at 28 to 29 months of age. In spite of the huge difference in age, the anatomical parameters were comparable between these two groups of rats. Both the chamber volume and ventricular mass to chamber volume ratio were similar. The same was true for hemodynamical parameter. Again, in spite of the difference in age, left ventricular and diastolic pressure, developed pressure, positive and negative DPDT were comparable, and this similarity in the anatomical and hemodynamical parameter resulted in a comparable diastolic wall stress. Finally, we found that growth factor treatment led to an increase in survival, and in the oldest group at 28-29 months of age, we increased life expectancy by 44%. I would like to conclude that the senescent heart contains a pool of functionally competent cardiac progenitor cells which can be activated by growth factor administration to migrate and differentiate into mature myocyte, converting a decompensated senescent heart into a younger, more efficient heart. And these are the people who actually did the work, and I would like to thank Arancia in particular, Conrad Marcello, and Dr. Anversa, who's my mentor. Thank you very much.
Questions? All these studies you've done is in rat cells?
Yes.
Have you looked at any human cells to look at the telomere? And
yes, we have done. Well, we have looked at human aging myopathy, and it has a characteristic very similar to what we have found in the rat. So we have seen a depletion of in the number of functionally competent cardiac progenitor cells and an increase in the number of senescent myocytes. And more recently, we have cultured in vitro the human cardiac progenitor cell, and we have found that even in patients, the average we obtain myocardial specimen from a patient undergoing coronary bypass surgery, and at least in this group of patients, the average telomere length is, I would say, normal, around 8-9 kilobase pair. It decreases with the serial passages, and the kind of decrease is approximately 1/3 base pair for each round of division, which is very similar to what has been seen for bone marrow cells. And after 25 passages in culture, there is a 50% decrease in telomerase activity.
Mary Loughlin, Case Western. Very interesting data on changes with aging in cardiomyocyte progenitor cells. Do you have any, my question is in many ways, data to indicate whether the changes that you see are related to the cells themselves or responding to stromal cells or other cells in the niche environment?
This is a very interesting question. For sure, I believe that aging is a process that involves both things. So there are cell autonomous changes, changes in the ability of the cell to respond to stimuli, and for sure changes in the environment. This, for example, has been done in the bone marrow and also in the skeletal muscle. They have found that there is a decrease in ligand of Notch, and we actually have similar results, and the Notch pathway seems to be downregulated with age, and the production of ligand from the supporting cells within the niche, which are myocyte and fibroblast, seems to be downregulated with age.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
So our last speaker of this section is Dr. Michael LaFlame. He's an assistant professor in the Department of Pathology at the University of Washington, completed the medical scientist training program at Emory University, and then completed his residency in anatomic pathology at the University of Washington Medical Center, where he also received a subspecialty in diagnostic training in cardiovascular pathology. He conducts research on the role of exogenous and endogenous stem cells in myocardial repair. His current research focuses on exploring the regenerative potential of intracardiac implants of human myocardium that are derived from human embryonic stem cells. He's also interested in the electrophysiological properties of human embryonic stem cells, as well as in efforts to use these cells to derive and better characterize the special cells of the early cardiac pacemaker and conduction system. Dr. LaFlame will share his information today about human embryonic stem cells for cardiac tissue engineering.
So I'd like to thank the organizers for the kind invitation and the opportunity to tell you about some preclinical work using human embryonic stem cells for both cardiac repair and cardiac tissue engineering applications. So we've already heard a fair amount this morning about human embryonic stem cells, what they are and where they come from. I'll just remind you in passing that these cells are derived from the inner cell mass of pre-implantation stage human blastocysts. For that reason, they're considered controversial by some. All of the work I'm going to be presenting to you today was done with federally approved human embryonic stem cell lines. And these cells have three undeniably useful properties for regenerative medicine applications. First, these cells can be isolated and expanded using reproducible protocols that have been successfully deployed in literally hundreds of labs. Second, these cells have seemingly indefinite proliferative capacity. And by that, I mean you can take a single undifferentiated human embryonic stem cell, put it through more than 100 population doublings, and still retain a cell population that has that stem cell phenotype. And finally, these cells are, of course, pluripotent. And by that, I mean they have the capacity, at least in theory, to give rise to all of the cell types of the differentiated postnatal organism, including, relevant for the present discussion, cardiomyocytes. And this puts these cells in stark contrast to many adult stem cell types for whom cardiac potential is controversial. Historically, the way most investigators have isolated cardiomyocytes from embryonic stem cells has involved their differentiation through spontaneously formed three-dimensional aggregates, so-called embryo bodies. Unfortunately, cardiogenesis is woefully inefficient under these conditions, so at best, anywhere from 0.1% to 1% of the total cell population in those embryo bodies will be comprised of cardiomyocytes. No surprise, a number of investigators are interested in trying to improve the cardiac purity that we can obtain with these cells. And one potential approach was reported by our group last year with what we're calling our directed cardiac differentiation protocol. In particular, this protocol involves the expansion of cells in the presence of mouse embryonic fibroblast condition medium, although other culture systems to maintain pluripotency work equally well. And then we induce cardiac differentiation by pulsing the cells with two growth factors that we knew from the embryology literature were involved in normal cardiac differentiation, namely activin A and bone morphogenetic protein 4. These are applied serially. And then if you look at the result in differentiated cultures 2 to 3 weeks after this induction, we reliably get preparations that are anywhere from 30 to 80% cardiomyocyte. And I'd like to emphasize that this is approximately two orders of magnitude greater cardiac purity than previously had been reported by other investigators, most of whom used embryoid body differentiation. However, if a greater degree of cardiac purity is required, you can this technique is compatible with subsequent enrichment steps. We've used Percol gradient centrifugation, which takes advantage of the unique buoyant properties of cardiomyocytes. We've now done this several times at a scale appropriate for transplantation studies. So I'm talking about preparations of the order of 10 to the 9th total cells, and reliably got preparations that were better than 80% cardiomyocyte. So this is just a little movie to show you what these cells look like. This is actually a directly differentiated preparation before Percol enrichment. About 50% of the cells you're seeing here are cardiomyocytes. One of the gratifying things about working with these cells is that they actually do something. So if you look at these cells about 10 days after induction, they'll start to show the spontaneous contractile activity. We've kept cells in culture for as long as 6 months, and they've retained this phenotype. So we've gone on to characterize the cardiac phenotype of these cells by a variety of approaches. Here I'm showing you some immunohistochemistry. The cells express cardiac troponin I, a sarcomeric marker, NKX2.5, a cardiac transcription factor we heard about in the preceding talk, sarcomeric myosin heavy chain, a striated muscle marker, and they have N-cadherin, which makes up the adherence junction portion of the cell necessary for intercalated disc formation and proper intracellular electrical communication. We've also done some biophysical characterization of these preparations. Here I'm showing you some action potential traces obtained using current clamp techniques. I can tell you that these cells have unambiguous cardiac type action potentials. In fact, one of the things that was surprising to me at first is despite the fact that we had expected these cells to be at a relatively early stage of maturation, they appear to have already declared themselves in terms of their cardiac subtype. That is, we see action potential traces with distinct nodal, ventricular, and atrial-like waveforms and properties. And one of the major efforts in my laboratory right now is trying to control the differentiation of these stem cells, not just into cardiomyocytes, but into the right type of cardiomyocyte for every eventual clinical application. And while I don't have time to go into those studies, I think we're getting reasonably close to deriving the homogeneously ventricular preparations that you would like to have for replacement of ventricular myocardium. So several years ago, we used even cruder preparations of human embryonic stem cell-derived cardiomyocytes obtained through embryo body differentiation with subsequent Percol enrichment and showed that you could take these cells, transplant them into uninjured, that is, uninfarcted nude rat hearts, and get the formation of large swaths of human myocardium. These cells expressed pretty much any cardiac marker that we could try. However, they look quite morphologically distinct from the host myocardium. And that's because, again, these are embryonic cardiomyocytes. One of the consequences of that is that they're chock full of glycogen, which gives them this sort of peculiar vacuolated appearance. One of the early things that came out of these early transplantation studies in these uninfarcted hearts is it turns out that these implants of human myocardium are very robustly proliferative. Here I'm showing you a human cardiac implant. It's positive for the human-specific myosin heavy chain isoform, the beta myosin heavy chain form. And as you can see, approximately 15% of these cells, this is a four-week-old graph, express the human nuclear antigen Ki67. This marker identifies all cells outside of the G0 phase of the cell cycle. And just to put this Ki67 fraction into some context, this isn't too dissimilar to what you would see with certain solid organ tumors. Similarly, we can pulse the animal with a thymidine analog BRDU. When we do that, it's relatively easy to find double positive cells, and many of these cells show mitotic figures. Now, this makes these cells very useful for regenerative medicine applications because it means we, at least in theory, could deliver fewer cells initially and take advantage of compound interest to get a functionally meaningful graft over time. So armed with this preceding experience in uninfarcted hearts and then our more recently developed cardiac, or more homogeneously cardiac, directly differentiated cell preparation, we posited this hypothesis a couple years ago, that these cells could be used to establish viable grafts within the much more hostile environment of the infarct zone, and that this transplantation would help preserve cardiac function. To test this hypothesis, we set up the following experimental design. So we infarcted again in a nude rat model, animals by using 60 minutes of ischemia followed by reperfusion. 2 days later, the animals underwent a baseline echocardiogram, and a subset of the latter animals were engrafted with 10 million of these Percol-enriched, directly differentiated cardiomyocytes. And in preceding work that I just don't have time to go into, we showed when we delivered these cells in the presence of a pro-survival cocktail, basically Matrigel with a couple other cardioprotective factors, it improved the efficiency of engraftment. And then we followed the fate of these engrafted hearts by histology and two functional parameters, echocardiography and MRI, up to a 4-week time point post-transplantation. And I'm happy to report to you that we found that we could reliably remuscularize, and at least in part, a significant portion of the infarct zone by implanting these directly differentiated cardiomyocytes. I'll draw your attention to this photomicrograph to the left here. This is actually the median example from this study. This is a near transmural infarct, so we have a little area of surviving immediately subendocardial rat myocardium. Most of the wall has been replaced by scar, however, and as you can see, growing out quite merrily within that scar are large islands of nascent human myocardium. They're positive for beta-myosin heavy chain, and we can confirm their human origin by subjecting this section to in situ hybridization with a human-specific pan-centromeric in situ hybridization probe. Oh, sorry, this is by an open thoracotomy. So we found surviving graft in 100% of recipients up to a 4-week time point. We found no teratomas. In fact, we could account for better than 99% of the human cells by the beta-myosin heavy chain marker. And we looked by very sensitive ALU-PCR techniques, and we're unable to find any human grafted distant organs. So we went on to immunophenotype these grafts by a variety of techniques. They express, again, beta-myosin heavy chain, the cardiac transcription factor NKX2.5, cardiac troponin I. We see what I would describe as episodic areas of sarcomeric organization. Where those are present, they appear to be in alignment with the host fibers. So at present, I can't tell you whether these grafts are active in vivo during systole, but I think this is at least good evidence that they're able to sense the lines of force within these rat hearts. A subset of the grafts express myosin light chain 2V, a ventricular marker. Most of the graft, as in the example I showed you in the preceding slide, were isolated from the host myocardium by fibrosis. We saw, again, what I call episodic points of host graft contact. Where present, we saw intercalated discs, as is highlighted by cadherin staining, that were shared between the host and graft cells. So we also looked at function. Here I'm showing you echocardiographic data where we're looking at fractional shortening. And you can think of fractional shortening as sort of the unidimensional analog of ejection fraction, which you heard about in the first talk in this session. This is a busy slide. I'll walk you through it. The black bar represents uninfarcted control animals. And then we had 4 experimental groups. So again, animals that received the human embryonic stem cell-derived cardiomyocytes, animals who received the pro-survival cocktail vehicle alone, saline or serum-free medium alone injection, and then to test the need for specifically cardiac cell preparation, we also delivered a non-cardiac human embryonic stem cell-derived preparation. Basically, just subjected the cells to the directed differentiation approach in the absence of cytokines. And so those cells were less than 1% cardiac. And what you would expect is over time, going from 48 hours to 4 weeks after the transplantation, that there would be a deterioration in fractional shortening. However, that phenomenon was completely attenuated in the recipients of the human embryonic stem cell-derived cardiomyocytes, statistically significantly different from controls. We also looked by MRI. MRI is useful because in the rodent context, this is probably the best way to get at regional wall motion. And so if I can draw your attention to the graft here to the right, we were able to show in the infarcted segment of the recipient animals some preservation of wall thickening that was unique to the recipients of the cardiomyocytes. As you would expect, if you look at the opposite uninfarcted walls, all groups look the same. Now, we reported these results just late last year. Interestingly, in the fairly short amount of time since, this has been, in essence, confirmed by 4 independent labs, all of whom reported the efficacy of the grafting of human embryonic stem cell-derived cardiomyocytes, all working in rodent infarct models. And I think now, collectively, this body of work provides excellent proof of principle and I think strong justification to move on to more relevant, larger animal preclinical models. At the same time, I was given the task by the meeting organizers to try and identify some of the remaining challenges to the successful development of these cells as a cardiac therapeutic. One issue that we've already breached is the need for preparations of increased cardiac purity. And one potential solution to this problem is the guided differentiation I described to you previously. Of course, further refinements are certainly going to be possible and perhaps necessary. One other obvious approach is to use cell sorting, using appropriate cell surface markers to either pull out cardiomyocytes or perhaps progenitor populations that can differentiate into a more restricted repertoire. And finally, Lauren Field's group taught us over a decade ago that by doing genetic selection on mouse embryonic stem cells, that we can derive preparations of cardiomyocytes that can be greater than 99% cardiomyocyte. A second issue is obviously the need to overcome the immune barrier. One potential approach is immunosuppression, which is obviously what we use in thousands of patients every year with whole organ allotransplantation. There are some other, I would say, more exotic possibilities, including the formation of hematopoietic chimerism, somatic cell nuclear transfer, or so-called therapeutic cloning. But the approach that I'm most excited about is the use of the recently described induced pluripotent stem cells. And Yamanaka's group in Japan has already shown that the technique that we developed to guide the differentiation of human embryonic stem cells into cardiomyocytes also works for these iPS cells. Another, I think, an often overlooked problem is the need to attenuate cell death post-transplantation. It's been shown by multiple investigators across a wide variety of cell types that pretty much any cells that you deliver into the infarct zone, greater than 90% of those cells will die within the short term. And I described to you the pro-survival cocktail that we developed that at least in part seems to overcome this. But again, I think this is an area where some further refinement would be very helpful. Another approach is tissue engineering. And tissue engineering offers the hope of providing attachment factors and other pro-survival factors in a more biologic context. And finally, I think there's going to be the need to enhance the maturation, organization, and electrical mechanical integration of these grafts. And again, I think this is a situation where tissue engineering offers us the best hope. So in the last couple of minutes, I'd like to describe some tissue engineering approaches that we're taking at the University of Washington that I think could be helpful with regard to these latter two problems. So one approach involves the use of scaffolds that try to mimic the microstructure of normal cardiac tissue. And if I can draw your attention to this SEM image to the left, I'm showing you that to remind you that every cardiomyocyte is fairly close to a capillary. So this intimate relationship between the microvasculature and the cardiomyocytes, I think, is going to be very helpful in getting something that will look like endogenous cardiac tissue. And we've been working with Buddy Ratner's group at the University of Washington to make templated scaffolds that have something that kind of recapitulates this architecture. Their group is providing us with templated scaffolds. These are made out of polyhema, which is the material used in contact lenses. They've modified that so it can be biodegradable. And they're templating these with two structures. So first, we have these large myofiber voids. And the idea is that these would be of the order of 60 to 100 microns in dimension, and we could occupy those with cardiomyocytes. And then the materials surrounding those have these interlocking spherical voids within them. And the idea is that you could pre-seed these spherical voids with either endothelial cells, other mesenchymal cell types, or in separate work, the Ratner group has showed by controlling the diameter of these spherical voids, you can invoke a Bricks angiogenic host response in the recipient animals. And here I'm showing you an in vitro example of one of these scaffolds that we've seeded, again, with these human embryonic stem cell-derived cardiomyocytes. This is perhaps better visualized in these digital volumetric images I'm showing you here. And one of the nice things about these scaffolds, in addition to their ability to sort of recapitulate the native architecture of cardiac tissue, is they greatly facilitate high-efficiency seeding and highly occupied scaffold. And that's because these large voids basically act by capillary action to very efficiently pull the cardiomyocytes into them. And that's very helpful since we're dealing with a non-migratory cell type. And so we're now able to get constructs that are fairly generously occupied. One of the other nice things about these constructs is because there are these interlocking spherical void spaces within the material itself, we get some exchange deeper into the scaffolds, and so we're reliably able to get scaffolds that are greatly exceeding the 100 micron diffusion distance you would otherwise expect. We're working on another approach that sort of almost has the opposite philosophy, and these are scaffold-free human cardiac tissue patches. And the way we make these is we differentiate the human embryonic stem cells using the directed differentiation procedure I described to you earlier. We then take those cells, put them in suspension culture on a rotating orbital shaker, and if you do so, after 2 days, you get these human cardiac tissue patches, sort of a spontaneously contractile sort of cardiac pancake, if you will. We can control the size of these patches by varying the cell number as well as the rotational velocity within the shaker. This is an H&E image. As you can see, one problem or remaining challenge with these scaffolds is we do get a necrotic core deep within the interior of these patches. So one thing that we found in examining these patches is that the cardiac progenitors that occupy them appear to mature over time. Here I'm showing you a histologic section through a day two cardiac patch. A majority of the cells express the cardiac transcription factor NKX2.5, but you have to look very hard to find cells that are expressing beta-myosin heavy chain, the sarcomeric marker I've used in earlier studies. If we look, however, at an 11-day time point, the cells have greatly hypertrophied and now exuberantly express beta-myosin heavy chain. In addition, there seems to be a trend towards an increase in cardiac purity over time, at least in the outlying areas of the scaffolds. We're also working on vascularizing these patches by co-seeding them with endothelial cells and fibroblasts. So here I'm showing you a series of sections. We're staining either with beta-myosin heavy chain, a cardiac marker, or CD31, an endothelial cell marker. As you'd expect, if you seed the patch with just cardiomyocytes, you only see cardiac staining. If we co-load the cells with an equal number of cardiomyocytes and human umbilical vein endothelial cells, we get both cardiomyocytes and endothelial cells. However, those endothelial cells are just present in large, sort of unorganized clusters. If, however, we administer three cell types, so cardiomyocytes, endothelial cells, and mouse embryonic fibroblasts, we start to see those endothelial cells organizing themselves into structures that look like the endogenous microvasculature of the heart. And importantly, endothelial cells and fibroblasts are mesenchymal cell types that we can also derive from human embryonic stem cells, or perhaps in an autologous fashion if we so want it. So to wrap up, I've shown you that human embryonic stem cell-derived cardiomyocytes have an unambiguous cardiac phenotype, and I described a directed differentiation protocol using serial application of activin A and bone morphogenetic protein that results in efficient and reasonably pure cardiogenesis. I've shown you that these cells can form implants of robustly proliferative human myocardium within the rodent heart, and I've also shown that the survival of these grafts in these hearts can be greatly enhanced by the use of a combinatorial pro-survival cocktail. I've shown you that this results in remuscularization and attenuated loss of cardiac function. And finally, I'd emphasize that tissue engineering approaches hold significant promise in improving the state of maturation and organization of these cardiac implants. I'd like to wrap up by thanking those that contributed to those studies, and if there's time permitting before lunch, I'd be happy to answer a few questions.
In the beginning, you expressed an idea, and I'm wondering whether that idea can be generalized. The idea was is the idea of directed differentiation of stem cells. Is that an accepted idea, and in how many cases has this idea been tried successfully?
By successful, do you mean taking it to therapy to the bedside, or do you mean validating it in vitro? I think if you mean the latter, there's lots of precedent with mouse embryonic stem cells, which we've had for a while, and more recently with human embryonic stem cells, of guiding those into useful differentiated progeny. I don't think that this is by any means the last word in terms of cardiomyocytes. Other investigators are working on other approaches. Many of you may have seen a very nice paper by Gordon Keller's group just this month in Nature, in which they described a protocol that's actually fairly distinct from ours. So I think that this is not only sort of a validated approach. I think it's going to be a necessary approach. We know that the developing embryo makes a heart, and it does it right. And so I think we need to go back as much as we can to the developmental biology literature to sort of learn from those lessons.
First of all, thank you for showing us the dynamic and codependent relationship of the cells in their extracellular matrix.
Yes, yes.
But my specific question is, it looked a little bit like in those very early slides where you were showing us the movie of the cardiomyocytes beating in synchrony. They look like across the entire culture there was some real electrical coupling there. Is that just an artifact of the movie, or was that real as a reflection of your particular differentiation cocktail?
No, that's real. So these cardiomyocytes do express connections, gap junction proteins. They form intracellular communications with each other. So sort of depending on the geometry of the cells in the dish, you can even get a dish where the whole well, if you will, is beating in synchrony. And other groups have shown that if you co-culture these cells with primary cardiomyocytes, say rat neonatal cardiomyocytes, that these can act as a pacemaker and drive the contractile activity of those cells as well.
I think part of the reason I asked that question is, and I'm not sure how well I know the literature, but I know there are some suggestions that if you use certain cell types that might have a memory, so to speak, of a muscle-type phenotype in transplantation studies, there's some suggestions that there's potentially some electrical abnormalities. I'm wondering if some of your differentiation protocols, in addition to the fact that you're using earlier-stage cells, might get around some of those issues.
So that's an excellent question. Obviously, the ability for these cells to electromechanically integrate with the host is a good and a bad thing. It's a good thing in the sense that, at least in principle, these would have the ability to contract and synchronize with the host. Of course, if they're going to drive arrhythmias, this is obviously going to augment that as well. These cells are at a fairly early stage of development, so if you look at their profile of expression of gap junctions, it's sort of on the low end. They tend to be distributed isotropically throughout the cells. So electrical conduction with these cells in vitro is fairly slow, and I think that's another instance where maybe not their guided differentiation would be helpful, but their organization into these tissue engineered constructs, which we could maybe condition in vitro, get the cells to show the axial alignment that we know normal cardiac tissue has, could be very helpful and may be necessary.
So I have a couple questions. So you showed nicely that your in vitro differentiated cells have the positive markers that you expect for an immature cardiomyocyte. What about factors they shouldn't be making? Have you used microarray technology or other methods to ask, are they making proteins, factors that normal cardiomyocytes do not make?
So again, 20% or so of the cells are non-cardiac. We haven't looked by array, but we've looked with a battery of immunocytochemical markers to see who those may be. And right now, I can really tell you better who they're not than who they are. We don't see neural cells present. We don't really see any ectodermal cells at all. I think some of those cells are endodermal. They don't seem to express alpha-fetoprotein, however. And we don't see any endothelial cells. So that's actually one of the problems. We're in the perverse situation, I think, of now wanting to go back and dope these cells deliberately with contaminant cells, but the right type of contaminant cell. But that's an excellent question. I mean, I think almost as important as can you get a homogeneous cardiac preparation is if you're going to have contaminating non-cardiac cells, who are they? And being able to make sure that it's not the right type of cell.
The other question is, in your in vivo experiments, do those cells stop proliferating? Do they know to stop, or do they keep going once they've grafted?
Right. So that's an excellent question. So we've looked at these grafts as late as 10 weeks, and basically the proliferation appears to be tapering off, but it's not completely gone at a 10-week time point. So 1 week after transplantation, I think we had a Ki-67 fraction of 25%, declines to about 15% at 4 weeks, and at 10 weeks it was the order of about 5% or so. I mean, one thing to keep in mind is that these are cells that presumably are on a 9-month developmental program, and so they may be proliferating, you know, for sort of that period of time. But they do appear to be slowing down somewhat.
Just comment on that from my talk. In the brain, we see exactly the same thing. We see proliferation for around 10 weeks, and then they stop. It's like they have an endogenous need to proliferate a few times. And
right.
There's some evidence from, you know, Ron's early work that the cell has to divide in order to make a cardiomyocyte, or in our case, it has to divide to make a neural cell. It doesn't just morph from an ES cell-like cell into the final tissue. So I think the division is actually something necessary. I had a more specific question, and that is, have you looked at other muscle types like skeletal muscle with your protocol rather than the spontaneously beating type? Is that the other 30%, or what other sort of types of muscle do you think you can generate?
So that's an excellent question. We've looked with the embryo body differentiation approach that we and others were using earlier on. If you wait long enough in those cultures, you can see skeletal myotube formation. We don't see those. We've looked with a large number of skeletal muscle markers and don't see in these directly differentiated cultures any evidence for those cells being present. And if you look, you know, with very sensitive RT-PCR techniques, we don't see MyoD, other skeletal muscle transcription factors.
So how do we get those? Question.
So I guess the short answer is I don't know that, but I think it can be done. It's going to involve a different sort of timing and set of induction cues.
You said that your patches aged over time. Do you see a change in expression of major histocompatibility factors on the cells as a function of time. And as an add-on, have you changed or modified your pro-survival cocktail as a function of that answer?
So interesting question. So we haven't looked at that specifically with the cardiac patches. What I can tell you is even these early differentiated cardiomyocytes are immunogenic, so they'll express MH1 and 2. I would expect that would be true in the patches as well, so, particularly with endothelial cells present in those. All right, thank you very much.
I was just going to make a few comments about the cardiovascular cell-based therapies. We feel that at this time that it is an attractive approach to prevent or reverse heart failure due to infarction and also to enhance the development of new vessel cells for myocardial ischemia. But we have to remember one thing, that although there's been some clinical trials that have taken place, the field is still immature and we need to do much more work and be willing to go back from the clinic, back to the lab, and back again to the clinic. In addition to the safety and efficacy phase one studies that have to be done, we still have answers that are needed, for example, in immune rejection, in arrhythmias, in tumor formation, and so on. So the NHLBI will be releasing shortly a program that is called the Progenitor Cell Consortium that will be emphasizing things as basic mechanistic studies in progenitor cells, in IPS, and so on. So I'm not sure when the date is, but it'll be probably in the next week or so that you should be looking out for this new consortium that we will be supporting in the next year. Thank you very much, and I think we're going to break for lunch, 1 o'clock. You should be back.
Okay. I would like to introduce our first speaker, Dr. Terrence A. Partridge. Dr. Partridge recently moved here to the Greater Washington area and is a principal investigator at the Children's National Medical Center. He's also emeritus professor of experimental pathology at the Imperial College School of Medicine in London. Dr. Partridge has worked for many, many years on trying to identify cells that can carry out muscle regeneration, has learned a tremendous amount of information about these cell types and also on how to manipulate these cell types in terms of trying to cure diseases. He and his group were the first to try a gene therapy approach in terms of trying to correct a gene defect in muscle cells, and has learned a lot of information about the potential of these cells and also the potential hurdles that have to be overcome before this type of therapy would be routine. So thank you, Dr. Partridge, for joining us today.
Thank you very much. It's a great pleasure to be here to represent a majority tissue, I think, in a minority context, which is the stem cells. Do I do anything with this? We'll clip this on somewhere. Right. So I'm going to talk about muscle replacement in a couple of contexts, if I can get this clipped on. No, I can't. I'll put it in here. I won't move much. And I'm going to talk quite a lot about this cell here, which is the satellite cell, which lives on the outside of the muscle fiber and is held responsible for much of the regenerative response of muscle. It was first described in 1961 by Mauro as a cell living in a little indentation, a groove in the surface of the muscle fiber and underneath the basement membrane that covers the muscle fiber, and was more or less instantaneously accepted as the likely stem cell, the candidate stem cell for muscle. But it's been very hard to get really rigorous evidence that this is so, and it's only in recent times that we've been able to do so. So I will describe that a bit. And so it's held responsible for putting in new myonuclei into muscle, especially during growth and repair and in regeneration of new muscle. You can see an example of that here. So this is a piece of normal mouse muscle. If you inject a myotoxin like notexin, snake venom, into it, then within a day, actually, it's fully degenerated, and within 3 days, it's full of cells, most of which you can't identify very easily, but a lot of them are inflammatory. By 5 days, 2 days later, you've begun to get large numbers of new muscle fibers forming in this site, and by 10 days, you have a whole field full of new muscle fibers just waiting to be re-innovated. And so it's a very quick process, very rapid indeed. It's so rapid that for many years, people didn't believe that muscle regenerated at all because they didn't see it happen. And in the UK, at least, the surgeons still learn that muscle doesn't regenerate. It's only replaced by scar tissue. A study several years ago showed that most of the cell proliferation in such an acute event actually happens between the second day and the fifth day. It's a very narrow wave of regeneration. And when you consider that many of these cells, the satellite cells, are really only between 2 and 5% of the total, they do have to move very fast in order to totally replace that tissue in the time. In mice, they have the decency, when they've regenerated, to leave a nice string of central nuclei at the middle of the muscle fibre, which tends to stay there for much of the mouse's lifetime as a universal marker. But they also replace the satellite cells on the surface. So I'm going to talk mostly about Duchenne muscular dystrophy, and this is a young boy suffering from Duchenne muscular dystrophy. He doesn't look particularly wasted, but he has problems rising from the floor, which he uses Gower's maneuver to walk up his legs. This is an older boy, and he's severely wasted by teenage, and if they're not properly managed, then they suffer from contractures and from scoliosis and really have a bad time, and most of them used to die before they were 20, but nowadays, with better management, they live much longer, or they can live much longer. This is a biopsy from a young Duchenne showing all the stages of degeneration and regeneration. These fibers here are hypercontracted because they've got excess calcium in them. These ones here have died and have been infiltrated by macrophages, and there are some satellite cells on the outside here. And these ones here are regenerating, newly regenerating fibers. And this process of degeneration and regeneration continues throughout the life of the lifespan of the boys and of the animal models there of this disease. The disease itself is due to mutations in the dystrophin gene. This is the largest known gene and encodes a very large protein which links the gamma-actin filaments inside the muscle fiber to a large complex of proteins and eventually to the basement membrane on the outside of the muscle fiber. So defects in this gene, or usually absence of this gene, causes disassembly of this whole complex. All of these members of this complex also are associated with muscular dystrophies. So defects in those genes also cause very similar overall symptoms. So why are we interested in reserve cells at all? Well, one of them is for myoblast transplantation, the idea of taking myoblasts from healthy individuals or genetically correcting myoblasts and putting them back and getting them during the regeneration process to put back new tissue with the good gene in them. This I will talk about a little bit, but I do think it's a spent force now. I don't think that's going to work at all. We're also interested in improving regenerations. What can we do with the endogenous regenerative capacity of this muscle? Can we optimize it in some way? And then lastly, the passion that dares not speak its name, which is, I think, at least it doesn't make much money, but it does give you an objective view of things, I think. So we started off with myoblast transplantation, which simply consisted of enzymatically digesting muscle and implanting them into a dystrophic mouse's muscle. Late on in the experiment, we took to irradiating this site with a high dose of X-rays to knock out the local precursors to give ourselves the best possible chance. And if you did that, you could get very good fields of dystrophin-positive muscle fibers. But they were very local. They stayed within a few millimetres of the injection site. The other problem was that the actual yield was poor. We only got back about a third of the amount of muscle we would have expected from a direct conversion of the cells we put in. And we were interested in why that was the case. So we put in radio-labeled cells where we'd use radio-labeled thymidine, and we also used male cells into female hosts. And what we found was that the radio-label disappeared over 5 days down to baseline levels, which told us that most of the cells we put in had died. The Y chromosome also went down initially, but shot up again with time. And so we've concluded from that that the cells that actually gave rise to most of that muscle were not the cells we've managed to label in the tissue culture, and therefore they were probably the most slowly turning over set, which suggested there were at least two sorts of cell present in those cultures, one of which was more stem-like than the other. This is a sort of a picture of the possible ways in which you could do this job. One of them is where you have a stem cell which divides asymmetrically on every division and gives rise to a string of muscle cells. And that does seem to be the case probably for normal growth. Postnatal growth is probably very close to that model, as I'll show you in a moment. The other one is the symmetrical division model, where the first division replaces the stem cell, and then you get a series of symmetrical divisions, which will give you a geometric expansion. And you must have that. That's the only way we can account for the increase in cell number over the 3 to 5 days of an acute regenerative response. So we were able to begin to look at satellite cells once we got decent markers for them. This is one of the markers that we have found, which was a negative marker, which you could take a mouse with to express LacZ off of the 3F myosin light chain, which showed up in all of the myonuclei and left only the satellite cells as an unmarked cell. You can see that negatively by staining with X-Gal, where the only unmarked cell is the satellite cell. So you could count those cells very easily as a negative marker. We talked to growing these fibres out in culture to see how productive they were. We knew how many satellite cells there were on a fibre. How good were they at making muscle? And so this is just a couple of fibres from a normal and a dystrophic mouse. But the point of it is that we were interested in the actual proliferation rates. So we counted the number of cells present 2 days out, and then the numbers of cells present in the same culture 3 days out, and got this sort of relationship. We also tried myostatin to see if it would inhibit the process, and it didn't. But what you will notice is that the slope of that graph is 5.5 to 6, which means that there are between 2 and 3 divisions per day in those cells, and that's the average division rate. We know that some cells are doing better than others, so it's a very fast proliferation rate, and will just about cover the amount of proliferation you need to totally replace muscle in that 5 day period. The other thing that happens is that you get asymmetric divisions as part of this process. So this is an example of a myoblast that's pulled off of a muscle fibre, and you can see this is just divided, and one of these cells is positive for the transcription factor myo-D, and the other one's negative. And we presume that the negative one's going to go back and become a satellite cell again, and that the positive one will go on and do all the divisions needed to replace the muscle. Now, the other type of division, the asymmetric series, the evidence for that is largely in man, and it has to do with the rate of loss of telomeres and the rate of loss of potential mitoses. And so you find that from young newborn children, you have between 55 and 60 mitoses you can get out of your satellite cells in a tissue culture. By the time you're 15, they've dropped considerably. And that rate of loss of division capability and of its associated loss of telomere implies that you're doing largely asymmetric divisions to over that period during growth. By the time you finish growing, you'll have about 20 divisions, and by and large you hang on to that until you're quite old. If you look at Duchenne boys, they've lost most of their divisions by the time they've reached teenage. This is just another example of the same thing. So this is the normal diminution of telomere length. This is the in culture. This is a culture from a 5-year-old. You can see it's already lost quite a lot. And this is from a series of adults. And you can see they've lost even more, but not hugely more. And even the 81-year-old is not that badly off. Whereas in the case of Duchenne dystrophy, you've got a very much lower start line, and the diminution rate is much sharper. So it does suggest that Duchenne's really don't have much in the way of divisions left in their endogenous satellite cells. So we've been interested in showing in recent times whether it really is the satellite cell, whether satellite cells themselves are the cells we're interested in, or whether there are other cells participating in this process. One of the ways of doing that is to take these muscle fibers and we can count how many satellite cells there are on them, and we can transplant a whole muscle fiber into a dystrophic muscle and follow what goes on. So we know that from the EDL muscle of the mouse, those fibers carry about 5 to 10 cells, satellite cells. It's a very small number. It's approaching so this is just to get back to the markers we have. So this is one of the markers, and I think I've got the other marker. The other marker is a positive marker of satellite cells, which is beta-galactosidase knocked in to the endogenous MIF5 gene, which is an early myogenic determinant factor. And that, there you can positively mark the satellite cells. So we have a positive and a negative marker of satellite cells. And that these cells mark for other now known satellite cell markers. If we take a single fiber with carrying, say, 5 to 10 cells and transplant it into a muscle, a mouse's muscle that we've pre-irradiated, you can see we get really about as many fibers as we do from transplanting 50,000 or 100,000 satellite cells. So the actual improvement in efficacy there is several thousand-fold, or tens of thousands of fold. So this is more like a true stem cell activity. We're actually getting back a lot more than we put in. And this is just a transgene marker to show that they correspond. If you take the rest of the muscle and look if you use a MIF5 knock-in mouse as the donor, then you can follow what the satellite cells get up to. And so this is, again, the site of a single muscle fiber transplant, and you can see that it's seeded the whole area with MIF5-positive cells, which are satellite cells. So it has actually self-renewed in a major way. It's behaved as a stem cell. But only a minority of cells seem to do this. That's not going to work. Nor is that. What I was going to say, before I was so rudely interrupted, is we've tried to test whether or not these cells actually retain any function, stem cell function. Are these cells themselves any good? And what we did was to inject the muscle with Notexin after it had been going for 4 weeks. So that's at about this time. And then look a week later. And a week later, there is, again, a massive regeneration. So these cells are perfectly capable of mounting two or three rounds of full regeneration at the site. So they are stem cells in that sense. This contains a bit of that data. So this is the... Horizontally, I've plotted the number of fibers around each individual graft using three different markers. And so on this side, there are the ones that were not injured. So this is a five-week-old graft of a single fiber from the EDL, the soleus, and the tibialis anterior. And this is a series of grafts from animals of the same age, where 1 week before we looked, we injected with Notexin and provoked a fresh round of regeneration. And you can see that they do equally well. What you can't see here is that for the tibialis, the EDL muscle cells, many of the fibers produce nothing. That could be ineptitude on our part, or it could be because there isn't anything capable on those fibers of making a regenerate. And we think it's the latter, because if we use the soleus muscle which is the same size but has about 2 to 3 times as many satellite cells on it, in every single case we can get a graft at the graft site. So we feel that these absent grafts actually reflect a genuine null result, i.e. those fibers carried no cell capable of behaving as a stem cell. So the satellite cell compartment, we think, is robustly regenerative, or at least part of it is. It replaces itself in addition to regenerating new muscle. It sustains several rounds of repeated regeneration, which makes it at least a minimal stem cell. It loses most of these properties when we take it off the fiber. Really, if you take them off, they do not do anywhere near as well. They lose thousands or tens of thousands of fold of potential. And they only work if we pre-irradiate the environment. And that's reminiscent of what happens with bone marrow transplantation, that you have to actually create a space for these cells to manifest their properties. How am I doing? Not too bad. Why doesn't myodrast transplantation work? One of them is that there's lots of cell death, as I've shown. There's poor proliferation of the implanted cells. They don't move very far, and there is rejection of mismatched cells. That's not going to work either. Oh, well. C'est la vie. So this was going to be a picture to show you that if you
if you inject cells, this is the work done by Jacques Tremblay, who's worked a lot on this cell transplantation idea, that cells do not move more than about a millimetre from the track of the needle, and that would have been shown there. And I'm not quite sure what would have been shown. This is a set of papers, two of them from the Italian group led by Giulio Cossu, and one from Bruno Pio's group in Pittsburgh, to show that people have turned their interest towards the cells associated with the blood vessels, particularly the pericytes in muscle, as a source of stem cells. And that also would have been very nice if you could see it. I should probably have used my own computer. Windows and Macintoshes don't mix well. So what this would have shown was there is a cell associated with the small vessels in muscle, which is marked by alkaline phosphatase, which is the pericyte. And the Italian group extract those cells and grow them in culture. And another one. Yes, it's not a good computer, is it? I wonder what was on what that was. Pardon? Well, I don't think I'm going to have time to change over. Yes, I'm not too sure about that. So I'll go on to the last thing. So one of the big problems with Duchenne is fibrosis. So what actually disables the muscle from working is the deposition of dense fibrous tissue in and around all of the muscle fibers. This is very tough stuff. And plainly, having inelastic material in a mobile tissue like muscle doesn't work very well. And so we're interested in this as well. You can see it in the dystrophic mouse as well. So this is a young dystrophic mouse, stained for type 1 collagen and for basement membrane type 4 collagen. And you can see the deposition progressively of lots of type 1 collagen, which is the dense scar tissue, in the interstitium of the muscle fibers of these mice. We found that the satellite cell is a potential partial culprit in this process, because, can you see that properly? We looked for collagen 1 and collagen 3, and in both cases we identified the satellite cells with a cocktail of markers against all of the developmental stages, and we showed that the satellite cells were making both type 1 and type 3 collagen. We don't know how much, and that's one of the interests is to see whether we could modulate that, because this is a major part of the pathology of this disease. Can we divert them from this pathway? So, to get to my conclusion. So the satellite cell is tissue-specific stem cell, in effect. Their progeny have little migratory capacity. They can't move far from the graft site, so I don't think that using them for a cell therapy is on in a broadly diffuse tissue like muscle. Expansion in tissue culture diminishes their myogenic capacity, and that's what's been found for almost every sort of myogenic cell that's been looked at except one. And by adulthood, there is a limit on the number of cell divisions. They're down to about 20 divisions left in each of those cells by the time you stop growing. And they also make these profibrotic proteins like collagen and fibronectin, so they are a culprit as well as a good guy. The mesoangioblast, which you would have seen a lot more of had the computer worked, displays general stem cell functions. They can turn it into a variety of different sorts of cell. They can be delivered via the vascular route, which is one of the things you'd have seen. So they're able to inject them arterially or intravenously, and they lodge in the local blood vessels in the muscle, clamber out, and start making muscle, which is not a thing that satellite cells can do. And that makes them potential. That gives them potential for a stem cell-like therapy. In this case, growing them in tissue culture is required to make them acquire these myogenic characteristics. So that's also a very different feature. By adulthood, there is also a limit on the number of divisions. They're also down to 20 divisions in the adult. And so they're actually no better than the satellite cells in that respect. They do not replace satellite cells. And they do not seem to be involved in normal myogenesis. So when they've taken these cells from normal and dystrophic humans, they've found that they behave more or less the same. Whereas the satellite cells get exhausted by the business of being in a dystrophic muscle, these mesoangioblast precursors do not get exhausted, and presumably have taken no part in the process. So they're not involved. So they're a mystery in terms of their cell biology, but they do look like the best bet for a therapy. And that's it.
Questions? While we're waiting for people to come to the microphone, it's very striking that the satellite cells that leave the muscle fiber and grow in plastic are so less efficient than the ones that are on the fiber. Do you know what the interactions between the satellite and the fiber are that kind of maintain that stem cell property?
The truth is no. So what we know is that if you take them off the fiber mechanically, they do less badly than if you take them off enzymically. And if you take them off enzymically and use them freshly, they do better than if you culture them. So there seems to be a series of things they don't like about the various stages of being put into culture. And that's all we really know about that. It does seem to be true of a lot of the other cells. So the vessel-associated stem cell described by the Pittsburgh group also does not grow well in culture, at least does not preserve its myogenic qualities well in culture. So culture does seem to be bad for these cells and to remove some of their stem cell-like qualities.
So what causes the fibrotic response of satellite cells? Why don't they do that in normal muscle?
They do.
They do.
So what you saw was actually on normal muscle.
Normal muscle.
But they do it equally on normal and on... I mean, I had some pictures that you might have seen had things work properly, showing a normal muscle from an old mouse, and the fibers are encased in a network of type 1 collagen. So
there is not additional fibrotic response in dystrophic muscle. There is no additional fibrotic response.
Oh, there is
in dystrophic muscle.
Yes, I think the inflammatory events that occur around the degeneration of muscle fibers drives it excessively in dystrophic muscle. So there is an excess of fibrous tissue in MDX mice and in Duchenne boys. And in me, probably, because if you have sports injuries, you develop these things.
I wanted to ask you also about this point. And I wanted to ask you if there's more than one flavor of satellite cell and whether this kind of collagen response is like the sort of classical differentiation of a fibroblast into multiple fates. So is that information about the differentiation of mesenchymal precursors into muscle or fat cells or cartilage relevant to this phenomenon that you're describing here?
Well, the nearest I have to an answer to that is that we've done it on C2, C12 cells, which are not my favorite cell. But they make collagens while they're proliferating, but as soon as they go into differentiation, they stop it. If you add collagen to them, it inhibits them from differentiating. So, to some extent, there's a positive feedback system in there. I don't know if it's a serious positive, but it's a potential positive feedback system. And that's one of the things we're looking at the moment. I'm getting off of C2, C12 cells and back onto primary cells to investigate the same things.
Here. You mentioned, if I understood correctly, that satellite cells lose their myogenicity in culture and with age in the end. Do we know why do they lose their myogenicity? Can we do something about it?
Yes. Well, in culture, lots of people have tried, is all I can say. I gave up on cell transplantation within a couple of years of realizing it was nowhere near efficient enough to work. But there are people who've persisted and who have regimes. But no one gets them going more than two or three times as well as the worst examples. So that it's not you probably need a two or three orders of magnitude improvement to actually get a feasible, plausible therapy out of it. As for the age thing, it's more interesting because I didn't show you also is that if you take single muscle fibers from very old mice, you put them out in culture, the cells do very badly in culture. If you transplant them, they do just as well as young muscle fibers. So there is a residue of cells on those fibers. They've lost lots of satellite cells, but what they've got left behaves just as well as the whatever's good on the young muscle fibers. So there's two separate issues, I think.
Thank you very much. I would like to now introduce our second speaker, Dr. Darwin Prokop. Darwin is currently the director of the Center for Gene Therapy at Tulane, but he's going to be moving shortly to the University of Texas in Temple. And Darwin started off his career, his long and very productive career as a collagen biochemist, and as such became very interested in a series of brittle bone diseases, in particular osteogenesis imperfecta. And in his quest to try and do something to treat children with this brittle bone disease, he came across mesenchymal stem cells, what are known by many as mesenchymal stem cells, and has spent a great deal of effort in trying to figure out how to use these cells in regenerative medicine. And he's going to be talking to us today about the use of this particular cell type in regeneration of skeletal and associated tissues. Thank you for coming, Darwin.
Thank you, Pam. A pleasure. Important to be here. So I have a very wordy title. Let me try to explain why. Because superficially, the cells we're dealing with look very simple. In truth, they are bedeviling. So the characteristics we know are they're plastic adherent, they readily differentiate into three lineages in culture, they rapidly expand in culture, but they're not tumorigenic unless you abuse them in culture. I think the evidence is if you abuse any cell in culture long enough, you get tumors out of them. So these properties are there, but we have no definitive epitopes, and we have little consensus even the name of these cells and the properties. So those are some of the problems in the field. The field really began way back in the early 70s, even 60s, by work by a man named Friedenstein in Moscow, and Tafazzoli in Italy, most of the same time. Very simple experiments. Took bone marrow from animals, put them in tissue culture flask, illustrated in the right here, and after about 4 hours, he poured away the cells that didn't stick, which was a shock to people dealing with bone marrow at that time. Duarte and all the rest, his predecessors, because he threw away the hematopoietic stem cells. And he said, if you look at those cultures carefully, you'll see only a few cells stick, maybe one in 10,000, maybe one in 100,000. They sit there at first, then they begin to grow rapidly. And if you do plate them in low enough density, they grow as colonies, single-cell-derived colonies. And he said, and others said at the same time, you change the medium in mysterious ways, they'll begin to make bone for you, fat and cartilage in culture. And they'll do that if you put them in capsules and put them in animals. The cells clearly had so amazing potentials. So here's an illustration of an experiment, just a slight improvement over what done way back in the 70s. Microtiter plate, one cell deposited in each of those wells by machine, it's split for us. Come back in 2 weeks. Depending on your prep, 80 to 90% of those wells now have a colony. Reproducible. But you may note the colonies are a different size. And one amazing thing about these cells is you pick up a large colony, plant it again this way, you get the same thing, small colonies and big ones. But easy to clone without much trouble and without cell fusion in culture. And, as Friedenstein and the others said, take one of those colonies, single-cell-derived colonies, you can make adipocytes, you can make osteoblasts, where you spin them down in a microplate culture, you make cartilage. Amazing cells. Everybody who's worked with these cells really shares with me a feeling that they're magical almost. Under other conditions, more difficult to reproduce, you can make myotubes and neural precursors. So the fascination with these cells has continued and grown. So they've become in the forefront of regenerative medicine, illustration of what you can do with them, bringing them with marrow. You can use them to improve bone marrow transplants. You can use them to improve bone healing. You can use them to create enhanced vessel regeneration, muscle repair, skin repair, heart repair, kidney, pancreas, liver, neural stem cells. In fact, if you think about this scheme, These cells hold out hope. They hold hope for any disease that affects these organs. We have a few steps to conquer, a few hurdles to conquer, to get there, to realize that hope, but it's there. Hard to recapture all the enthusiasm in this field for you. I tried to do this yesterday morning. Dialed up MSCs, one of three names for the cells, in PubMed with these tissues. Number of publications in bone marrow transplant related papers, 1,349. Bone repair and related things, 1,500 over. Blood vessels, over 100 or 100. Muscle, 265, skin, 67, heart, 177, kidney, etc. The enthusiasm out there in this country and the world for using these cells. Create these organs. And unfortunately, I won't have time to go into that. But I'm going to focus on how the cells can repair tissues. So, as Pam mentioned, our own interest in this field started here. We isolated human collagen genes, took a lot of time and effort, then we stood around the laboratory saying, what can we do with them? So we wanted to look for mutations. And the bet we made, and others made about the same time, was maybe in this kind of child, a child with osteogenesis imperfecta, brittle bone disease. Every bone in the body can break. Perhaps the cause is a defect in collagen, the major protein of a bone. And yes, it worked out. We and others found that most patients with this disease have mutations in type 1 collagen genes. There are two genes, two different chains with three triple helix. Most of the severe ones are replacing those 300-some glycines in each chain with a larger residue. It disrupts this triple helix and causes disease. So that was all very satisfying, but we had to face the question, what can you do for the child? What can you do for the parents, which are destroyed by children like this and their families? Could we ever repair all the bones? And that, as Pam mentioned, was really when we got into using these MSCs in clinical trials. So we did some experiments in transgenic mice with an OI defect. Ed Horwitz and Malcolm Brenner followed up with a clinical trial in Memphis. They took a child much more severe than the one I just showed, the children more severe. It's a genetic disease, so first they had to do barrel ablation. They did a bone marrow transplant from a normal brother or sister. Then 4+ years later, they came back with large numbers of MSCs from the same donor to the same child. So they could ignore immune rejection. And the result was very encouraging. At this age of 4 to 6 years of age, four of the five children had stopped growing. None of them could sit up on their own. After the therapy, they began to grow again, some at a rate of approximately cohorts the same age. Four out of the five were able to sit up by themselves for the first time and stand with support. Not a complete cure. In about 6 months, they tend to relapse. And it was not a complete cure of the disease, but very encouraging. The cells were doing something. But when Ed looked carefully at tissues he could get, for engraftment of the cells, and he had a genetic marker there, he could find very little engraftment. So we puzzled about that. We came up with sort of excuses, hypotheses, why we couldn't find the cells, but nothing was satisfactory. So in effect, we were dealing with a very simple kind of strategy. The idea was you take a few cells from a patient, grow up large numbers of these bone marrow cells, you expand them in a GMP facility, you bring back large numbers of those cells to the patient. The idea was simply to use mass action to force the repair process in the body. But it wasn't working as we predicted. Something was wrong with the scheme. So reminded of the saying by Niels Bohr, the physicist, scientists don't change their minds, they simply die off and the field moves ahead. So we went back to think a little bit. And it turned out we're kind of caught up in a simplified idea about stem cells. Human embryonic stem cells from inner cell mass, we heard earlier, pluripotent. Our cells, some of the properties of embryonic stem cells, but not all. Not all. And they could differentiate, but you had to, in fact, push them harder to many lines of differentiation. And in truth, the cells are not there to say, serve mainly as stem cells, they're more cells for repair. That's a general statement. Let me try to justify it to you. So yes is the scheme that started us off, everybody in the field. But it turns out, based on recent data from a bunch of laboratories, the main effect of cells are to repair tissues. And they do this not by cell fusion or differentiating so much. They do it by secreting cytokines, related agents, that stimulate endogenous precursor cells and tissues. They modulate inflammatory responses, and they modulate immune responses. So let me just try to illustrate all that with three experiments from our lab. There are many more like this out there in literature I've referred to. Experiment one, inject human MSCs in a dentate gyrus, the hippocampus of mice, adult mice, region rich in endogenous neural stem cells. So we had a very clear idea what should happen here. These cells should divide there and grow in the central nervous system, as we had seen before injecting in newborn mice. They like to proliferate in culture. Why not do it in the brain? Well, these were our results. Can I use a pointer? Here's the injection of the human cells in the dentate gyrus. You can't get more than 100,000 in a reasonable volume, otherwise you cause damage to the brain. Here's an assay for dividing cells with a PCNA, real-time RT-PCR. Control side in solid bars, injected side in open bar. Clearly more cells were dividing at day one, day three, a bit more at day seven, and they're all the same by day 30. So we thought, okay, it's working. Here are controlled dead cells, no effect. But when James Minoza did the experiments, looked at the hippocampus, here were the dividing cells, and here were the human stem cells he'd injected with a specific marker in the control side over here. The dividing cells were not the injected cells. In fact, by data I won't be able to chance to go through, the story was, here are the neural stem cells, here are the human cells 3 days after injection. These are the cells that begin to divide, they begin to migrate, and after a while they differentiate into the three lineages of the central nervous system. So the actual result, limited proliferation of the human cells, marked proliferation, and neurogenesis, migration of the mouse cells. One effect of these cells. Experiment two. Human cells in the diabetic mice. And again, this is in concert with, consistent with many other papers now in the literature. Made the NODSCID mice, immunodeficient mice, diabetic, a standard method, streptozotocin, four small injections. Human cells, day 10, into left ventricle. And again, another injection, day 17. We didn't quite know what the best time would be, so we took two time points. Then we measured diabetes in these animals. Critical features of the experiments explain, I think, why it worked. Multiple low doses of STZ, so we got severe hyperglycemia without needing insulin, and most of the cells could survive without insulin treatment, which complicated the experiment. Cells in the left ventricle, we didn't want them trapped in the lung. And the results. So I point this out because Rong Ma Lee, the postdoc who said you want to do this experiment, I told it won't work. It worked. She's smiling, I'm smiling. Blood sugar, control mice. We began to lose them out here from polyuria, severe diabetes, injected mice. Clearly lower blood sugar. As you might expect, blood insulin went up. Diabetic mice, treated mice. Controls. Not quite level of controls, but clearly higher than the diabetic mice. But the assay was for mouse insulin, not human. So the cells were producing, or somehow inducing, greater production of mouse insulin. Looking at the pancreas, diabetic pancreas, treated, controls. Islets here clearly were bigger, not quite the same as the control. More. But the staining for mouse insulin, less here than there, than here in the control. So the main thing was happening here, islets were bigger, and they were producing more mouse insulin. In one mouse out of 12, there were a few human cells there you could find producing human insulin, but it's hard to find. So the main effect was not the human cells synthesizing insulin. So, in the pancreas, a minor effect was the human cells producing human insulin. Never saw that in the bloodstream.
major effect was to increase mouse islets producing mouse insulin. We also saw engraftment of cells in the kidney, human cells, clearly about one per glomerulus, and the histology of the glomerulus improved. We did not have albuminuria here, so we can't get a true functional improvement, but there was some kind of improvement there. Seems quite simple. Make diabetes, inject cells, the mice get better. But what's the explanation? Not quite obvious to you or to us. Maybe the cells are doing what I just showed you in the hippocampus, stimulating the mouse endogenous stem progenitor cells. Not sure. But maybe they're decreasing inflammation and immune responses, which is something that happens when you damage beta cells with strep azitocin. So, experiment three. Human cells in a dentate gyrus after transient common carotid occlusion in mice. A little bit related to the earlier talk you heard today. TCCAO, 15-minute clamping, not longer than that, carefully done. A day later, human MSCs injected into the dentate gyrus. Tests for neurological deficits, allosequences assay for human cells, and cell death. It's an interesting model. It produces ischemia followed by reperfusion. The neurological deficits are extreme, and there's neuron death, global death throughout the whole brain. But there's a delay of 3 to 4 days. And that, of course, is a window for therapy. Very important to think about in these diseases. Human cells into the mice, the mouse hippocampus. Number of cells here, day one after injection, seem to be an increase, but it's not statistically significant. And then rapidly the cell disappearing. 3 days, that's 7 days. Now, one surprise for us was, it didn't matter whether we used immunodeficient mice or immunocompetent mice. The cell disappeared about the same time. So the cells are not there for long. But, and you can see that they're not there for long by immunohistochemistry here, using the HUN, human nuclear antibody. Very few cells there, larger enlargement, larger magnification. Yes, they're in nuclei. The human cells are there, but very small number. But the changes. Untreated mice, neurological score, don't improve over this 4-day period. Marked improvement in the mice that received the cells, with a P of 0.01. And we measure dead neurons by dye staining, nice decrease in dead neurons. P-value 0.05. Cells were there shortly. It was a hit and run, in effect. Did their job and then left. So we had a chance here to explore what was going on with microarrays as a survey what was going on. So here's a comparison on a mouse microarray of vehicle HBSS injected in the uninjured brain versus injected into the ischemic brain. And things change, as you might imagine. Ischemia changes the genes being expressed by the mouse cells. At least 586 genes are upregulated on the scale here, and about 41 are downregulated. Not a big surprise. But then looking at the brains of the mice that received human cells, you can see a difference. So this is, again, the same RNA on a mouse array, looking at ischemic with vehicle versus ischemic with human MSCs. Three mouse genes that were already up were further upregulated by the human cells. Two out of the three turned out to be neuroprotective, lysozyme and something called YM1 I'm going to come back to in a little while. And 80 genes here were downregulated by the human cells being there. Most, by GO terms, are inflammatory and immune response genes. So dramatic effects just by the human cells being in the brain. But we use the microarrays in still another way here. We had enough human RNA there to put the RNA on human chips. So we compare human MSCs in uninjured brain versus human MSCs in ischemic brain. And now what you see is 189 genes, human genes, now upregulated by being an ischemic brain versus normal brain. And some 54 downregulated. And pretty much
the genes that are downregulated or upregulated are involved in inflammatory immune reactions. So this point in itself may seem minor, but it's a major one. These cells are doing something different in culture as they're doing in normal brain, as they're doing in ischemic brain. It's a key feature of them. They go into a damaged microenvironment, they behave differently. Tremendous implications for how they can be used. So our results simply said this, neurological deficits were decreased, neuron death decreased, and the microarray suggested the human genes had reduced inflammatory and immune responses. Only suggestion, microarrays have their limitations. So what we could follow up with is looking with ELISAs and other methods, quantitative methods, is there an increase in inflammatory, anti-inflammatory, or anti-immune cytokines in the mouse brain? ELISA for IGF-1 clearly goes up in the hippocampus if the human cells have been put in, not in control. This is a cytokine that's co-expressed with many anti-inflammatory cytokines, encouraging confirmatory what we're looking for. Bigger change than that, even, in something called galectin-3, a cytokine expressed by activated microglia and macrophages. Nice increases in the hippocampus, but even seeing increases in cerebrospinal fluid, which left open the opportunity to follow these cells with these mice with time without killing them. It's a cytokine expressed by activated microglia and macrophages, with very good differences here. Might say in all these experiments we have not been able to distinguish between its microglia or macrophages coming into the injured brain. This galectin-3 is being expressed in these microglia or macrophages. So you stain for galectin-3, CD11B, you get co-localization. Another marker for microglia or macrophages, you get co-localization again. And then YM1, also known as CHI313, which went up in the microarrays. Couldn't do that by ELISAs, could do by Western blotting. 2 days after the ischemia, up in the control, not quite as far in the MSC-treated preside, but 4 days later, the cells clearly have increased the level of this protein. And same thing shown by staining of the cells, increased YM1, a neuroprotective gene, well documented in literature by work by others. Again, the value just expressed here. So, what's happened is complex. Should be no surprise. Tissue injury's got to be complex. Responses to tissue injury have got to be complex. And the treatments have to be complex. So we summarize things by saying we have ischemia, reperfusion. That's a stress, particularly a stress on the human MSCs put in the brain. They normally express MSC1. They somehow influence the microglia. Didn't show you this. They increase expression of MSC2. They put out IGF binding proteins of various kinds, TGF betas, and they absolutely increase the levels of YM1, GAL3, and IF1 being produced by the brain of the mouse. And these effects have the effect of tipping the immune balance toward TH2 from TH1. They have the effect of decreasing apoptosis, decreasing inflammation, and immune responses. Now, wouldn't be fair to close these comments without referring to a very important paper that just came out in Cell Stem Cells. It's an elegant paper demonstrating this is what happens with these cells, immunosuppression activity. MSCs, the first step is they're activated by IGF-gamma to consortium with one of any three other cytokines. The cells get activated. They express cytokines that now attract T cells. At the same time, they express iNOS and nitric oxide. So they attract the T cells, and the nitric oxide produced by the MSCs suppresses the immune reaction. It's a beautiful explanation of some observations that have been made by others for a number of years, that the MSCs in animal models are immune suppressive, and in patients they seem to suppress graft-versus-host disease. So, perspective. Tremendous enthusiasm, huge amount of work being expended on these cells and related cells from bone marrow. It's not a myth. What we're seeing is dramatic effects many times, as I tried to illustrate, without the cells engrafting very long, without much evidence of fusion or differentiation. We don't know the details of that. Huge amount of work needs to be done.
But at the same time, these efforts, I think, reflect hope on the part of the investigators and hope for the patients. So diseases of any of these tissues potentially are targets for the therapy. That's where the field is going. So beginning with these kinds of observations, the emphasis now is going from replacement of tissues in many of these diseases to repair. Many of the mechanisms of these actions of these cells are still a mystery, no question about that. But they're not theoretical in terms of use in patients. There are multiple clinical trials going on with MSCs, you heard in part, and related cells in bone marrow, you heard this morning. Graft-versus-host disease, spinal cord injury, stroke. It can almost, it's difficult to think of a disease and not on the list for somebody not trying some kind of therapy. Especially in heart disease, over 30 reports, phase one or phase two trials. Are they working? Hard to summarize them all. I think most agree, with the exception you heard from Dr. Lasorda this morning, results are encouraging. But, and a big but, many without good controls, again, what Dr. Lasorda pointed out, for conditions of the patients, for routes of administration, for dose administration, and most troubling to me of all is the nature of those cells, going back to my first slide. There are subtleties there which we have not been able to resolve. But that should not be a surprise. I think you can generalize to say development of dramatic new therapies has never been a linear process. We begin with basic research. It's never as good as you'd like. We go to animal models. The results are never as good as you like. And that's a matter of judgment. Risk to patients and benefit to patients. Animal models are particularly difficult for repair processes, because it turns out rats and mice heal so much better than you and I do. If you don't kill the mouse or rat with something like a burn or damage the liver or other organ, it survives and you come back in a few months, you can't find the damage you've done. We're not like that, unfortunately. So it always will be a risk, potential judgment, risk against benefit of pursuing these therapies. If you think back on Stu Orkin's very nice summary this morning, if we had waited until we fully understood hematopoietic stem cells, there'd be thousands of patients out there who would not have benefited from bone marrow transplants. That may not be the best example, but I think there's an analogy there. I think we can all agree we're exploring a new frontier of biology and of medicine, and simply we don't know the limits of it as yet. Thank you.
So in the experiment where the transplanted mesenchymal stem cells restored glucose control to the streptozotocin-treated mice, do you know if the MSCs stimulated the proliferation of the damaged beta cells, or did the MSCs promote the differentiation of a resident progenitor cell?
Oh, I wish I could answer that question. Our experiment did not speak to that. Very important. We really don't know whether, you know, this argument about other stem cell-like cells, progenitor cells in pancreas. Our results just did not address that. Don't know.
Okay. Thank you.
Sorry. We'd love to answer.
I have a question regarding these are human cell transplants. A lot of the data into rats, the xenograft model. Have you tried mouse mesenchymal cells into mouse in those same models? Do they have the same effect? And that's sort of relevant for the human trials because humans is human to human, whereas the studies you showed are human to mouse. Do you think there's something there that may stimulate the immune system more because it's a xenograft, or do you like to comment on that?
Good question. It turns out that we'd love to do more experiments with mouse MSCs. They turn out to be extremely difficult to grow and expand in culture. So either they don't grow or they go through immortalization and transform on you. So we actually have a center for distributing standardized cells of human, rat, and mouse. But we warn people about the mouse cells. Their chromosomes are unstable. So other people have used them in experiments like this and gotten comparable results. We decided to switch to the human because for some reason they're much more stable, easy to deal with.
In your microarray experiments, after you transplanted the cells in and then you show the retrospective microarray analysis, did you use laser capture or how did you get the human cells back out to do the analysis?
Plus no, it turned out with 100,000 cells injected, we still had enough out of day three to do the microarrays. And we take a... So what we did first was to use a human GAP-DH real-time RT-PCR assay first to be sure we had enough human RNA, and we had enough to pull it off, yes. And we also only took out the hippocampus, of course. We localized the cells.
Yeah, going back to your diabetic mouse experiment, where you suggested that the transplantation of human cells induces the production of mouse insulin, but not the human insulin. Now, may I assume that the explanation is not as simple as the following, that the human cells are producing some soluble growth factor which is taken up by the mouse and produces insulin because mouse has the receptor, but is not taken up by humans because humans have no receptor. In other words, that paracrine loop is working, but the autocrine loop is not.
No, good thought. I certainly agree. We do think the human cells are producing something that stimulates the mouse cells, yes. The human cells in that model are there longer than they were in the global ischemia model I described. They were there after 2 weeks after the last injection in pancreas and in kidney. But, yes, I think they're producing cytokines or chemokines that are controlling, modulating the situation.